You wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
When tourists come to us, they often assume parallel universes are rich with complex and exotic civilizations. The truth is quite different. When we find a parallel universe that has humans, and that's extremely rare, we almost never come across complex societies. Advanced technology, written language, armies, monuments. These things are actually quite unique. The first step to exploring a new parallel universe is to send in a drone to gather information. Occasionally, a drone will image a family of nomadic hunters. If we're really lucky, we'll find a small tribe. This is fascinating from an anthropological perspective, of course, and there are many scholarly periodicals that focus on just these kinds of worlds. But, as I say, finding more complex societies than this is very rare. That's why I want to tell you about an interesting world, a parallel universe that breaks the mold. A few years back, one of our drones imaged a nomadic family in the jungles of South America. We sent an agent to investigate. This family helped our agent survive for the first year and hinted at a larger community further downriver that wasn't imaged by the drone. The agent explored downriver. After many months, she found a complex society we might call a proto-civilization. It was sedentary, had some stone monuments, a simple pictorial language. This discovery on its own would have been huge news for all those anthropological journals. But there was something more, something that would turn this from an anthropologist's thesis project into one of our best-selling tourist destinations. That's because our agent came across a traveling diplomat from a distant land. He wore a white linen robe embroidered with blue alabaster. He had gold jewelry in the shape of snakes, cats, and alligators. This diplomat was from Pharaonic Egypt. Please put on your costume now, as I continue your orientation. As you've probably guessed, we're sending you to Egypt. But this Egypt is a real enigma. In our timeline, large and powerful civilizations, such as the Hittites, competed with Egypt. But in the timeline we're sending you to, Egypt stood alone. No other people advanced to anything resembling the complexity and power of Egypt. Without competition, Egypt thrived for thousands and thousands of years. Now, we could send you to any number of fascinating eras in its long history, but because we know you're more inclined to adventure, we've selected a time that should prove exciting. We're sending you about 20,000 years after what we traditionally know as the founding of Egypt. So much time has passed that the Earth has entered a new climactic era, with a slight increase in the Earth's axial tilt. The world has entered a new ice age. The Sahara is now washed with monsoon rains and has begun to sprout into a scrubby wasteland. Meanwhile, the melting glaciers that fed the Nile with rich, fertile waters for thousands of years have now frozen solid, and the river has slowed to a trickle. The riverbank is no longer able to support its massive population, and an exodus of starving peasants and city dwellers continually pours into the wasteland. While this is happening, whole nations from a frozen Europe are pouring down into Egypt in search of new homes. Egypt is like a great mixing bowl of cultures. It's an impoverished, violent, and extremely dynamic time to live. We're sending you to the city of Memphis, the capital of Egypt, about 30 years after this dramatic climate change started. Many people are old enough to remember what it was like before the weather changed. Your cover story is that you're a traveling Celt from the frozen north. Our agent has set you up with a job as a tax collector. It's a fairly rough job, but a lot less physically demanding than, say, working on the pyramids. Well, it looks like you're ready. That flax cloth looks warm, if not uncomfortable, and this thick skin overcoat and hat with dried rosin should hopefully keep out the rain. I would imagine the leather boots will prove invaluable in the mud. You look like you could join the crew of a fishing trawler. Now, let me just say this. You're about to enter a society, an ancient civilization, that's dying. When a civilization dies, morality often grows loose. In other words, good people do bad things. Try to judge the good from the bad by their character and not by their actions. Such subtleties may help you survive. Good luck.
"That's the house," Amasis says.
Amasis is a tough old man with a leathered face and scorched eyes, shaded under the wide brim of his rain hat. You're in an old neighborhood of mud brick homes built on top of one another over the millennia. The constant rain has caused the ancient mountains of architecture to melt, turning the neighborhood into a great, contorted pile of mud, like a termite hill. Amasis starts across the street, followed by the other tax collectors, Ramses and Satya. You follow at the end.
"Are you Teos the carpenter?"
Amasis says. A pair of eyes peep through a crack in the mold black door. "Who are you?"
"You've got a delivery."
What is it? Amasis kicks the door, and his great foot goes right through the rotten black wood. The man on the other side yelps.
"Help me out, dammit,"
Amasis says to his son. Ramses pulls his father's leg out of the hole, then rams the door with his big shoulder. It shatters in a spray of black mold. Satya turns to you, her leathery old face as hard as bronze. "This is your first collection, so stay out of the way and just watch," she says.
"So it says here that you owe the state 5 deben of silver," Amasis says. "Now, I'm going to assume you and your pretty young wife are honest people. Forgetful, but honest. So, we'll make this quick. Give us the silver, and we'll be on our way."
The young couple stand against the wall of the small, one-room home. They look terrified.
"You look like cats with your tails up. Relax. It doesn't have to be silver. We'll accept the same amount in copper, won't we, Ramses?"
"That's right, Pop."
"What do you say? How about that copper?"
The couple says nothing, but just tremble.
"Ah, negotiating. We can negotiate. Look, we're not bad people, just doing our job. Isn't that right, Ramses?" "You can pay in installments. Now, what can you afford today?"
The carpenter looks at his wife, then back to Amasis.
We don't have anything."
"There's always something, boy. Always something. I've never come across a home that didn't have something. Ramses, have you ever come across a home that didn't have something?"
"Never once, Pop."
"How about you, Satya?"
She slowly shakes her head.
"Tias, I've been doing this for 20 years, and I've never once come across a home that didn't have something. Now let's try that again. What can you afford?"
The carpenter looks at his wife, and she shakes her head, subtly, just for him. Amasis pulls out a piece of wet papyrus and studies it.
"Percinet, it says here. That's your name, right?"
The young woman flinches.
"How long have you been married to Tias?" "No, don't answer that. It says 1 year. Now look. I know this carpenter husband of yours doesn't make a lot of money. It's not like the old days. So you want to keep a little something stashed away, right?"
The woman shifts her eyes and looks to the floor.
"You're a responsible woman, right? Times are tough. There's no work, and you're living in this melting house. Holes in the roof and everything. Maybe you've got a little one on the way. You've got to think about the future, right?"
The woman's lips tremble and her eyes fill with tears.
"I can tell you want to do the right thing. Now, you've been married a year, and I know you're a smart woman. So you keep a little of your dowry tucked away."
The woman's eyes flash at Amasis.
"Now, don't you worry. We're not going to take everything. Just what you can afford. So, my sweet little Lily, what can you afford?"
We don't have anything."
Amasis turns to Ramses and Satya, and then nods.
"Stand back and watch," Satya says to you.
She takes the carpenter and presses him into a chair. Ramses pulls out a hammer. He breaks the carpenter's hand with a few powerful blows that sound like thunderclaps in the small room. The young woman screams.
"There's always something,"
Amasis says. The young woman's mouth is agape.
"Now, go get your dowry, young lady.
2 copper coins tinkle into your outstretched palm.
"That's training money," Amasa says. "Don't worry, you'll get paid properly, just like Satya and Ramses here, when you start contributing. Maybe next time you can carry the hammer. Satya here will show you."
"It's easy," she says. "Just 3 hard blows to the hand. It works every time."
"Well, not every time," Ramses says.
He gives a sly grin and hands you the hammer. His cruel, beady eyes search your face for weakness. You quickly take the weapon and slip it under your coat.
"Damn Twilight Histories," you say under your breath.
The rain suddenly grows heavy, and you have to pull your skin collar around your neck.
"Let's get out of this rain," Amasa says to Ramses. "We'll see you tomorrow."
Satya turns to you, her rough, old face relaxing into something sad.
"Come on, let's get a drink," she says.
Satya takes you to the overgrown Giza Plateau at the edge of the city. There's a bar she likes that looks out onto the massive expanse of moss-covered pyramids. The rain patters against the skin awning of the bar, and the miserable customers hunch over their drinks. Everyone tries to position their chairs closest to a small open fire in the center of the patio.
"Look at that. It's a disgrace," Satya says, stretching her tattooed hand out to one of the really ancient pyramids that's being torn down by teams of workers. "They're tearing down a pyramid to build another pyramid. What a waste. It's insane. Pointless. Just leave it there."
"Yeah, you'd think they could find something better to do with all that labor," you say.
"That's what I've been saying for years. This old city is crumbling, and here we are, moving stone from one pile to another. There's something broken."
She taps her temple with her glass of watered-down beer for emphasis.
"How many are there?" you say.
"What, pyramids?
Oh, hundreds. Who knows?
You know, I remember when they weren't covered in moss. This whole area was filled with canals and gardens. It was like one great oasis. Now it's a garbage dump.
Look over there, a shepherd grazing goats in a pile of trash. You'd never see that in the old days. And look over there in front of the pyramids. You see those little black dots?"
"Yeah."
"You know what those are?"
You shake your head. "Each one of those black dots is a criminal hung up on a cross. You'd never see that in the old days. Not when I was young."
You squint your eyes. Hundreds of little black dots come into focus. Maybe even thousands, stretching off to the horizons.
"Where'd you say you were from? Someplace up north?"
"Yeah,"
you say, trying to remember your cover story.
"The snows got bad. There was no more food, so I came to Memphis."
"Well, let me tell you, this city used to be great. When I was a kid, it was clean, no black mold, no rain or snow to melt people's homes. People had work, and families could raise their kids properly."
"You seem pretty concerned for your people."
"Don't you care about your people?"
"Yeah, of course, but, you know, we just broke a guy's hand and took all his wife's money."
Satya's leathery old face turns red in annoyance, and she glares at you. She takes a deep swig of beer and slams the clay cup on the table.
"I didn't mean to. You just seem to care about your people is all."
"I didn't pick this job." "You don't pick your job here. Your job picks you."
"I guess I have a lot to learn about Egypt," You think those poor bastards up on the pyramid picked their jobs? Look at them, slaving away in the rain, pulling stones off one pile, moving them to another. They work from sunrise to sunset, burning their lives away. How hard did we work today? Let me tell you, we've got it good. Yeah, we've got it good, I'd say. She takes a deep draught from her cup, and you can see her short white hair from under her skin cap. The snows are coming too. I wouldn't want to be out there on the pyramids. I don't think I'll ever get used to the cold. She stretches her hand out to the fire. You turn in your chair and feel the hammer poke into your thigh. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about this job. You can feel however you like, but you're a foreigner and damn lucky to have this job. Someone paid a lot of money to get you a tax collector, no doubt. So just let that sink in. I'm just not sure I can do this. She wipes her chin with her big, rough hand. She looks like she's about to scold you, then leans back, her eyebrows furrowed in thought. Yeah, I remember when I first started. It was rough. But you get used to it. It turns into a job. When did you start doing this? Oh, I was pretty young. I guess they figured I was a bit of a fighter growing up, so they figured it was a good fit for me. Still, you know, breaking people's bones for not paying taxes is pretty different than fighting thugs on the playground. Makes you feel like a bit of a bully. You had a rough childhood? She takes another long, deep swig. Look, you're going to be fine. Just get in mind that it's a job. You're not a bad person for doing your job. And you don't have a choice anyway, so it's not your fault what you do. Wake up, wake up, wake up! Amasis pulls the skin door open on your small, melting room. It's raining hard outside, and the water pours off Amasis' wide-brimmed hat in little rivulets. Ramses and Satya are standing behind him. We've got a busy day ahead of us. Ready to earn some Deneb? Yes, you say, trying to sound tough. You still got that hammer? Amasis chuckles and looks at his son Ramses, whose eyes twinkle with cruelty. Satya looks at you with stiff, determined eyes, warning you not to respond. You walk across town to the bank of the Nile, now a deep, muddy swamp filled with garbage and the wreckage of old boats. A massive obelisk lies half-sunk in the mud, spillage from some ancient barge accident. Even here in this thick swamp strewn with garbage and rotting boats are scattered hundreds of skin tents, a shanty town of poor immigrants from Europe and destitute Egyptians who lost their homes either to the rains or the tax collectors. This is where I grew up, Satya says near here. This used to be a beautiful river. You enter a run-down apartment building near the river. The entrance is grand but decrepit with chipped and graffitied columns. There are old, faded frescoes in the halls, and the drunks and prostitutes give the crumbling palatial building the sense of having long passed its glory days. I I won't knock again, Amasis shouts at the door. After a brief pause, he nods to Ramses, who breaks the door in two with his heavy boot. A woman stands in the hall with a knife. Behind her is a young girl, perhaps only 5 or 6.
Hi, love. Why don't you put the knife down and we'll talk? Do you know why we're here? You owe some taxes. Get out of my home. Now, I know your husband died out in the pyramids, but taxes are taxes, and we have to collect. Now, why don't you put the knife down? Get out.
Look, love, we're all reasonable people, just doing our jobs. And we don't want any trouble. We'll be out of here as quick as we came. I know things must be tough, not having your husband to help bring home the bread. It's tough bringing up a little one without her daddy. So I'll tell you what, we'll do it by installments. That's fair, isn't it, Ramses?
Yes, Pop.
Just give us 1 deneb of silver now, and you can pay the rest later. How's that?
Get out.
Now, love, we're not going to leave without something. So why don't you just tell us what you can pay?
I don't have anything.
There's always something, isn't there, Ramses?
Yes, Pop.
Hi, sweetie, what's your name?
Don't talk to her.
It's Naparye, isn't it? That's your name. Here, I've got something for you. You must be hungry. How about a candy? A little sweet pork.
Get away from her. Get out of here.
Ramses, take that knife away from her.
Ramses steps towards the mother, and she slashes wildly at him. He screams and grabs his face. Blood squirts through his fingers.
That's it,
Ramses says. He grabs her wrist and twists hard so the knife clatters on the floor.
You all right, Ramses?
I don't know, Pop. I think she cut my eye.
Amasis looks back at you. His face is red with rage, and he motions at the hammer. You look at Satya for guidance. She's sweating, and her eyes dart back and forth.
What do I do? You ask her.
Come on, she says.
She stops and leans close to Amasis.
Not the kid. Let's let the kid go. She shouldn't have to see this.
Amasis looks at Satya with disgust.
Do your job!
They stare into each other's eyes for a tense moment. Satya finally breaks the gaze and walks towards the woman.
Come on, she says to you.
Satya holds the woman down, pinning her hand on the table. Ramses holds the little girl with one hand, his eye with the other.
I think she cut my eye good, Pop.
Amasis can hardly contain his anger, and his lips quiver as he sits opposite the mother.
Now, my little lily pad, how about those coins?
Please, we don't have anything.
There's always something.
Your hand sweats as you pull the hammer from your coat. When the woman sees it, she begins to cry.
You're breaking my heart,
Amasis says. He nods at you. You raise the heavy bronze weapon, but can't seem to bring it down. Amasis growls and snatches it. He slams it down on the woman's hand 3 times, then looks over to Ramses, bleeding, and slams it down 4th time. The woman is bent over, silent, accepting the pain.
Now, what have you got for us, love?
She doesn't respond.
Ramses, take the girl and let's go.
No, you can't, please. I'll do anything. Just don't take her, please.
Amasis shoves the woman back into her seat.
Satya catches her by the shoulders.
You can see her at the pyramids.
No, Satya says.
What was that?
Satya looks sheepish but determined. I said, no. We're not taking the girl from her mother.
Amasa starts breathing heavily.
Step outside, Satya.
He walks slowly towards her, and she lets go of the woman's shoulders. She stands a couple inches taller than Amasis.
Let the girl go back to her mother, she says.
Amasis slams the butt of the hammer into Satya's stomach. She falls back against the wall, breaking the rotting plaster with her big fighter's form.
I said, step outside.
She picks herself up and raises her fists. Amasis leaps at her. She punches his wrist so the hammer falls to the ground. But with a series of well-placed blows, the more experienced Amasis quickly gains control. He straddles her arms and pulls a small blade from his belt.
The hammer crushes his skull before you realize it was in your hand. Pop!
Ramsay screams and rushes at you. Satya leaps up and punches him in the face. His eye pops out and lands on the floor. He looks down at it in horror, then turns and runs out the door. Satya is about to run after him when she almost trips over the mother lying on the ground, the blood pooling around her. She leans down and checks her pulse.
She's dead. That bastard killed her.
The little girl is watching, trembling, silent.
Come on, we've got to get out of here. We're fugitives now.
Satya! I haven't seen you in years.
The man opens the door with a smile, then looks surprised to see you and the little girl. He's a big man, middle-aged with thick black hair and a long beard. He wears the skin apron of a butcher, covered in dark blood.
Yeah, it's been a while, eh, Abar? Not since the orphanage.
Who are your friends?
Listen, Abar, I'll explain later. We need a place to stay, someplace safe.
Of course. Anything for you, Satya. Are you in trouble? Have you a price on your head?
We just need a place to lay low for a few days. Even just the night would be a great help.
Yes, of course.
You cram into a woodshed in Abar's small enclosed yard. It's mostly empty and is just big enough for the three of you to sit in the dark. The rain drips from the roof, and there are rat droppings on all the surfaces. There's an old bronze axe wedged into one of the logs. You sit with the girl while Satya looks nervously through a crack in the door.
What are we going to do?
You say.
We've got to leave Memphis.
Leave? Where to?
We'll go out into the wasteland for a while.
Are you kidding? Isn't it crawling with bandits? And where will we stay?
I don't know. Anything will be safer than Memphis.
You look up at the leaking roof and suddenly appreciate the little amount of protection it offers. Isn't it going to snow soon?
Yes.
I just don't see where we could stay out there. It's a desert.
It was a desert. When I was growing up, at least. Now it's coming to life. There are even farming communities out there.
Really?
I don't know.
Wait, shh. What is it?
Shh. Satya looks through a crack in the shed's door.
Okay, enough of this. What is it?
Something's going on inside the house. I can see lights.
It's probably just your friend getting ready for bed.
No, I've got a bad feeling about this. We should go.
The light coming through the cracks grows brighter.
Soldiers, Satya says.
She reaches over and grabs the bronze axe, then runs out of the shed. You watch as she slams the axe into the belly of one of the soldiers, but then she's quickly overpowered by the others. The soldiers rush in and drag you and the girl out of the shed. You pass Abar and watch as a soldier hands him a bag of coins. He looks guilty.
Times are tough, he says.
Your body is sore from the vigorous beating you received, and one of your eyes is blistered shut. Your arms and legs are tied with leather thongs to the cross, and then you're raised up. You can see a small group of gloomy people huddled in the square. They're yelling obscenities. The rain has turned to sleet, and your exposed body shivers unbearably. A moment later, Satya's cross is raised next to yours. This sparks a riot of catcalls from the people in the square. Some throw stones at her. They know her. Maybe she collected taxes from them. Maybe she broke their hands. Ramsay steps out from the crowd. His cruel face is twisted into an ugly grimace. There's a bloody cloth wrapped around the side of his face, over his eye.
You killed Pop, he says, and you took my eye. It'll take days for you to die on the crosses. I'll come back every day and watch. I'm going to enjoy this.
The biting cold, the thirst, and the hunger is nothing compared to the constant and unbearable pain in your limbs. You're supporting your weight with a variety of muscles, jockeying back and forth as their strength gives out. Every time you relax and just hang on the cross, your chest constricts. You find it difficult to breathe.
And so, all through the day and into the night, you're forced to work, lifting yourself up, supporting yourself. You feel like Atlas, carrying the weight of the world, endlessly, mercilessly, without rest. During this marathon, this unbelievable struggle, you forget all about the gloomy people of Memphis walking through the square. You forget about Satya. You're focused in the zone, trying to will your collapsing muscles to keep you breathing, to keep you alive. Day 2. You are freezing and exhausted. Your strained and painful muscles can do no more than keep you breathing shallow, short breaths. Your head dangles on your neck. Your arms go limp, shivering against the ice. Your legs bend over, jerking now and again to help you gasp for air. You are in a half sleep where time has no meaning. The cobblestones turn into faces from childhood, family members, a lost life. Day 3. Your arms have pulled from their sockets, creating fires that extend down the length of your body, stretching your tendons to the point of snapping. Only your legs can support you now, and they're too exhausted to even jerk you up for a quick breath. You're suffocating. The world grows black in a sea of stars, only to snap into focus in brief, terrifying moments. You're dying, painfully. You're hardly conscious, but you feel oddly lucid at times. While everyone who passes must imagine you to be dead, in your rare, lucid moments, you feel a kind of triumph, a sick horror at having fooled them all. Your mind is able to compute this world. You can see, feel, and remember. You're also going through something unimaginably significant. It is the shoppers and commuters who are asleep, unaware of your immense struggle, your battle for life. Day 4. Death is coming fast. Breathing is almost impossible, and your muscles have completely atrophied. You're frozen black. The pain has morphed into something impossible. But as your body starts to shut down, and your mind can no longer process the pain, everything turns numb. First, your extremities, your hands and feet. Slowly, your arms, legs, torso. Soon, you're just a head, drooping eyes, a mind, a dream. You see Satya hanging on her cross. How horrific if your body looks like hers. Her arms are stretched impossibly long, her shoulders popped out of their sockets. Her head dangles limp, jerking once in a while as she flashes in and out of consciousness. There's a light coating of snow over her body, and her skin is turning black and
birds peck at it. She must be near death. A body like that, a twisted, horrible, frostbitten body like that, you lose consciousness. In your dream, the snow stops and the night sky opens in an explosion of stars. An old woman dressed in black peers into your eyes with a pale, white, emotionless face. "Death," you say to her. You float off the cross and into a wheelbarrow where Satya's peaceful body already lies. A skin sheet floats over you. From under the sheet, you see Memphis bump along, but you're invisible to this world. A ghost, a spirit being taken by the demonic creature of death out of this nightmare, out of the streets and down, down into the underworld. Into a dark, warm cave, and into sleep. It's over. It's finally over. A dim world of stone lit by fire comes into focus, and you see the bloodless face of the old woman inches from your own, her pale eyes trembling with age.
Could be, she says. Now drink.
You feel a spout on your cracked lips, and the sweet taste of water drips onto your tongue. Without the muscles to swallow, you sputter and choke.
Slowly, slowly, she says. Try this instead.
She wets a cloth and puts it in your mouth. With her help, you manage to close your lips around the cloth, and your mouth grows moist. You're snapped out of your dream, and you let out a whimper.
"I had to pop your shoulders back," the old woman says.
Feels like it's catching on fire. The pain spreads from your shoulders, licking up and down your body as though it had been thrown into a furnace. You want to scream. You want to run. You want to escape the pain. But all you can do is lie on the bed under your covers and cry very quietly. The crying exhausts you.
"You're coming back to life," the old woman says.
You look over to see Satya sleeping next to you. Her lips are bloody and cracked, and her skin is darkened with frostbite. You lick your own lips. They're dry and blistered. You're in a dark room, warmed by small fires. Through the shadows, you can see thick columns with lily capitals. There are painted frescoes of men and women working in fields, swimming, catching fish. There are children playing in the reeds.
Your body is still on fire, but you can pull yourself up ever so slightly. There's a clay glass next to you. You reach for it, painfully, slowly, your shoulder burning, your tendons strained. The glass knocks over and shatters on the floor. You fall back into your furs, defeated. The door creaks open, and the old woman appears, silhouetted by the light in the hall.
"You're awake," she says.
"Yes," you say. She picks up the shards of clay. "Who are you?"
"I'm someone from Satya's past. Someone she won't want to see."
"What do you mean?"
"I'm old and I'm dying. I want to do something good before I die."
She lays a hand over Satya's forehead, then turns and walks out of the room. "You!" Satya says with wide eyes. She's panting hard, and the sweat drips down her forehead.
"You're safe, Satya. I'm not going to hurt you. You're in my house."
Why can't I move?"
"You were crucified, do you remember? I took you off the cross last week, and you've been here sleeping ever since. You're sick."
Satya looks like she's struggling hard to understand. Then her feverish eyes close, and she falls asleep. The old woman nurses you and Satya back to some form of health. Strength returns to your legs and arms, though your shoulders are still on fire. Satya's fever abates. She doesn't speak to the old woman, but glares at her whenever she enters the room. You feel almost embarrassed when she smacks the old lady's hand away when she tries to place it on her forehead.
"Who is she?"
you ask when the old woman is out of the room. "A monster."
"It's hard to see that. She's just a little old lady, as far as I'm concerned, and one that saved us."
"We have to leave here."
Satya tries to climb out of bed, but her legs still can't support her.
"As soon as I can walk, we're leaving."
"What did she do to you? Why do you hate her so much?"
I don't know why she's trying to help us. She's never helped a human being in her life."
"She said something when we first got here, something about her dying. She wanted to do something good before she died."
"Ha! Well, doing one good thing won't make up for the hell she put me through, and hundreds of other children, maybe even thousands. That woman destroyed a generation."
"She was someone from the orphanage?"
"She was the headmistress." You leave the room at night, creeping quietly through the old woman's cold terracotta halls. The back door opens onto an urban garden covered with snow. With stolen skins and furs, you crump through the snow to the back wall. Satya takes your foot and helps you over.
"Come on,"
you say, reaching your hand back over to her.
She pauses for a moment, looking at you, then turns and walks back to the house.
What are you doing?
No answer. You sit against the wall and feel the endless, painful minutes pass by. The boulevard is dark and unlit, but you can tell from the smell of the street and the shape of palm trees rising from behind thick walls that this is an affluent part of Memphis. Finally, Satya pulls herself over the wall and lands with a thud in the snow next to you. She smells of soot. Dark splotches of liquid drip into the snow.
Is that blood? What did you do?
Come on, she says. You trudge down the street, holding on to one another for support. Your muscles are still painful and weak. Then the mud brick walls glow, first a deep red, then orange, then a dancing yellow. You turn back to see flames lick up into the sky.
What did you do?
Satya doesn't answer. The rising sun lights 100 pyramids on fire, the accomplishment of a civilization now engulfed in flames. Each pyramid burns according to its age. The older ones, moss-covered, weather-beaten, smolder like embers. The newer pyramids, their casing stones, a smooth, icy polish, shine like brilliant red-hot flames. Orphaned and abandoned by their ancient relatives, the pyramids shine on like doomed torches in a wasteland of snow and ice.
Why are we here? You say, shivering in the early morning frost.
A small group of snow-covered skeletons dangle from crucifixes a few yards away. Though their flesh has been picked clean by birds, you feel you can recognize pain on their faces. Pain so deep, it's engraved into the bone. We're not leaving Memphis without her, Satya says.
What, the little girl?
Yes.
Let me guess, one good deed before you die.
You couldn't help the jab, not after what she did to the old woman. Satya looks at you, the fire from the pyramids reflecting in her eyes. You don't have to come, but I have to do this. She turns and walks through the snow towards the pyramids. Then she stops, her shoulders slump.
I would appreciate it if you came, though. I may need your help. If anything should happen to me, please bring that girl out of this place. Give her a life.
The workers are crunching through the snow in long columns. They wear furs, and their capped heads are drooping. They walk down roads that can only be distinguished by double rows of crucified bodies. There are many more of these gruesome spectacles than you saw from the bar the other day. As you merge into the column of workers, you can't help but look at the victims with a mix of pity and relief. Some are still alive. The workers you join are pale-faced immigrants from a frozen Europe. These are Celts, Greeks, Germans. The men have long mustaches, the women and children have dirty faces, and their eyes are cast down. This was the only work they could get.
"I'm looking for a little girl, about 5 years old," Satya says to a mother.
She shakes her head, too tired or too uninterested to answer. Maybe she doesn't understand the Egyptian language. Satya keeps weaving through the crowd of laborers, asking the same question of everyone she meets.
"Is she Egyptian or one of us?" a young man says.
"Egyptian, but she's new here, just picked up a couple weeks ago."
"Most of the Egyptians are building the new pyramid. Us barbarians strip off the old."
The two pyramids he's talking about lie ahead. The old pyramid is being picked away like a corpse on a cross by a flock of birds. The new pyramid is rising slowly from the snow, the ancient casing stones sawn down into sharp, clean lines.
"You there, who are you?"
You turn to see an Egyptian soldier on a camel. He's covered in thick furs and carries a pole axe that's pointed at Satya. On his helmet is a bronze snake.
"Just a worker, sir."
"You're an Egyptian," he says. "What are you doing with these barbarians?"
"I just want to work, sir."
"Well, you'll have to get back with your own kind. Come on."
You and Satya step out of the pack.
"Not you, barbarian,"
the man says. You suddenly remember you're posing as a Celt.
"Stay with these people," Satya says. "We'll meet later."
At the base of the old pyramid is a large casing stone lying on wooden skids and wrapped in thick ropes. You and the other Celts are put into lines and, at a command, pick up two long ropes. Then you haul. You feel fire in your shoulders. The pain is so great you almost collapse.
"Hey, you all right?"
a Celt with a red beard says.
"Just do what you can. No need to break yourself."
"Thanks."
It takes hours to drag the large stone down the road. The new pyramid looks close, but it seems no matter how long you pull, you never get to the base of the structure. What's most impressive is a large crane on the flat work area of the pyramid. From a distance, it looks large. But as the hours pass, trudging nearer and nearer, you realize just how massive the crane must be. You stop for lunch. You're given an old clay bowl, which is filled with a thin soup.
"Moss," the red-bearded Celt says. "Moss and rat."
You're so hungry you don't care. This is the first food you've had since yesterday at the old lady's house. You drag the stone up the earthen ramp and into the dark cavern of the new pyramid. This cavern winds its way up through the interior, snaking around the massive structure. You're surprised by how large the cavern is. It's wide enough so two teams can pass in the torchlight.
The wind cries through the halls as though the pyramid were weeping. Your eyes adjust painfully to the gray, overcast sky as the cavern spits you out into a large platform. It feels colder up on top of the pyramid, exposed to the wind and snow. There must be 1,000 workers here. They're sitting, huddled together in small groups for warmth and drinking soup. You realize how hungry you are. It's dinner time. You sit under the crane. Its beams are huge, and you learn they're hewn from entire trees, shipped in from Northern Europe, and strapped together. The crane is lifting a large stone, about the size of an obelisk, but thicker. This is a linth, a stone that will support the roof of the pharaoh's burial chamber. I don't get these Egyptians, the bearded Celt says, sitting next to you. They tear down one pyramid and build another. Makes you think the world's coming to an end. How long have you been here for?
Got here just before the rain started. I thought things would be better here in Egypt. At least they feed us 3 meals a day, which is better than starving.
Where are you from?
I'm Kimbri.
Wow, you've come a long way.
Yeah, I had to. Everything's frozen back home. There's nothing left to hunt.
How did you know to come to Egypt?
He looks at you as if you said something strange.
Everyone knows about Egypt, he says.
But I think I'll move on soon. It's better to take your chances in the wasteland than live your life here.
Fur-clad worker walks past and your heart stops. He's tall and has a patch over one eye. Ramses, what's he doing here? You turn so he can't see your face. Excuse me, you say to the Celt. You pull your collar up and start walking in the opposite direction from Ramses. Too late, he grabs your collar.
You!
His one good eye is contorted, and he looks like he could grind out his teeth. He kicks you hard. Everyone stops to watch.
Get up, murderer.
What are you doing here? You can't think of anything better to say. He pulls a knife from under his furs.
Hunting you, it looks like.
He puts the knife up to your throat. Then his one good eye squints into something evil. Where's Satia? He says.
I don't know.
Yes, you do. She went her own way.
No, she's here.
He paces and looks quickly around, then back to you.
You murder me and you'll be crucified.
I don't care. Now, you tell me where she is. I've got nothing for you. As if inspired, Ramses flips you over, face on the ground. He yanks your hand back hard, and you can feel the blade of the knife against your index finger.
If Pop taught me anything, it's that there's always something. You just have to know how to get it.
Wait, okay, I'll give you something, just let me think.
You've had plenty of time to think. Spit it out. Here goes your finger.
You feel a sharp pain as he opens your finger like a can.
The girl,
you say, and instantly regret it.
The blade stops winding around your finger and loses some of its pressure.
What girl?
You don't respond. Then you feel his warm breath against your cheek.
You mean that girl from back in Memphis? The one you two killed Pop over?
Wait. She's an orphan now. Maybe she was sent here.
Rising out of the dark cavern in the belly of the pyramid, you see Satya among a group of men and women pulling a large stone.
Ramses walks around you, stroking his chin. Then his eyes sparks to life. He reaches inside his furs and pulls out a crumpled piece of paper. He leans down to you.
This was our list from that day.
He runs his finger down it.
And here's the name of the girl. Naparye is her name. Oh, this'll be easy. I'll just find the girl and Satya will come running.
Satya and her team drop their ropes. She rubs her hands and begins to walk back towards the tunnel.
Well, your usefulness has run out, Ramses says to you. Time to die.
An Egyptian soldier runs over. Hey, break it up!
Ramses looks like a jackal choked on the end of its leash.
But... This is a fugitive, escaped from the crucifix.
Satya glances over and recognizes you and Ramses. She bolts towards the tunnel. Ramses sees her and runs to cut her off. Realizing she won't make it, she runs back and into the crowd. Soldiers are streaming out of the tunnel now.
Come on, you, says the soldier who approached Ramses. Better get you back on the cross.
That's far enough, a bulky, low-ranking officer says. A laborer stabs a spade into the frozen ground as your small party stands around watching. It's starting to snow again, and the soldiers pull up their fur collars. You're standing on the side of the road at the end of a long, double row of crucified bodies. Your wooden cross lies in the dirt. One of the soldiers pulls off your fur coat, and the freezing wind instantly claws at your body.
Lie down,
the officer says, and spits towards the cross. The other soldiers don't wait for you to obey, but grab your arms and throw you violently on the wood pole. Leather thongs are wrapped painfully around your wrists and ankles, and are then fastened to the pole. There's a notch carved out of the pole so you can support yourself with your heels. The cross is raised and then slams into the hole, shaking back and forth before settling. You scream in pain, then, desperately, try to get a foothold in the small notch to relieve the strain on your wrists.
That's it,
the officer says, and spits on the cross. The small gang of soldiers and laborers walk down the road towards the pyramid, leaving you alone and shivering. Across the road, a half-decomposed body hangs on its cross, with empty eye sockets and mouth gaping open. Then you hear the corpse scream,
a shrill, terrifying, unearthly scream. No, that sound is coming from your own throat. You don't know how long you scream. The sound keeps going on, until, at last, the world goes black.
Cut him down.
This is the officer's voice. You open your eyes and see him directing a couple soldiers. He looks angry. He's sitting on a camel, and the little girl sits in front of him. Naparie, was that her name?
What? What's going on? You say.
It's your lucky day,
the officer says as a ladder slams against the pole.
I don't understand.
That woman negotiated hard. Her life for the girls.
Your straps are cut and you fall to the ground. A soldier throws a coat on you.
She negotiated? But with what?
She ran to the crane and put a knife to the ropes. If she cuts the ropes, the lintel will fall.
You look to the pyramid and see the outline of the crane against the darkened sky.
Yeah, she's up there right now. And we have instructions to give you the girl and the camel. So, ride off into the wasteland. You're free.
He leaps down from the camel, spits. Your arms and legs are impossibly painful, and your body still hasn't warmed up under the fur coat. The officer leans in towards you.
You can run, barbarian, but as soon as this is over, we're coming after you.
You hold onto the girl and the camel tight as the animal races into the wasteland. Its legs pound through the snow and steam pumps out of its nostrils. You're racing towards the setting sun as though it were life itself. When it's gone, the last rays of warmth in this world will disappear, and then you'll be in the dark and the cold out in the wasteland. A desert of endless ice. You look back, not quite hoping to see Satya racing after you on a camel of her own. But you know that's impossible. She sacrificed her life for the girl. Whatever happened in her past that drove her to this decision, it's done. One act of kindness in a life of misery. Hopefully, her death will be quick and merciful. You look back again. There's something there. A cloud of snow near the base of the half-built pyramid. It's too difficult to see against the jostling of your camel, but the cold sweat running down your spine tells you what it is. You're being pursued. You've been riding late into the night, perhaps even into the morning, and your camel is exhausted. The girl is sleeping in your arms. She cried herself to sleep. She was so scared. You tried to explain everything, but nothing consoled her. What she really needs is her mother, and no words can bring her back. You come across a rocky outcropping. There are caverns and crevices, places to offer good shelter.
You feel your way into a cave. There's a fire pit filled with old ash, and nearby is a pile of wood and kindling. You can't help but wonder if this fire pit was built by bandits. And are they coming back? You and the girl warm yourselves against the fire.
I'm hungry, she says.
I know. Me too. But there's nothing I can do about that right now. We'll find some food tomorrow. You don't believe your words. The girl falls asleep, but you're wired. You leave the cave and climb the rocky ledge. The sky is just starting to turn blue. It will be morning soon. There's a tiny light in the east. At first, you think it might be the sun rising over the horizon, but it's too early, and the light is too small. As you watch, the light separates into 2, 3, 4, 5 tiny flickering lights. They're torches. You climb down the rocks, skidding and stumbling in your haste.
We've got to go, you say to the girl. Mommy?
She says, without opening her eyes. Your heart breaks a little. You pick her up and she curls into you and falls back asleep. Something's wrong with the camel. It gnashes and kicks at you. It hobbles in a circle, limping on one of its legs. You must have driven the animal too hard yesterday. It's useless now. You gently lay the girl back down in the cave. You grab a stick you used as a poker the night before. Even as you test the point against your finger, you realize how ridiculous this is. How could you possibly fight off armed soldiers, fight off Ramses, if he's there, with a stick? You climb back up the rock ledge and look out to the horizon. The torches are much closer. You can make out riders now, 5 of them. Then the sun crests over the horizon, and the riders toss their torches into the snow. You can almost hear them clomping and huffing. There are rocks around, fist-sized rocks. Yes, these will work better than your poker stick. You start to gather them. Your new plan is to stand on this ledge and hurl rocks down on your pursuers. But you can't leave the girl down there. You climb down and wake her.
Come on, Naparye. It's time to go. Can you hold on to my back?
She rubs the sleep from her eyes and puts her arms around your neck.
I'm hungry, she says.
Yes, we'll get some breakfast soon. We've just got to climb this rock first.
Okay, she says.
Impossible, you say, ducking. The riders are at the edge of the rocky outcropping. 4 of them are soldiers, one being the officer who raised you up on the cross yesterday. There's a 5th man, Ramses. He must have insisted on coming along.
Hey, barbarian, Ramses says. I know you're in there. You and the little girl.
You can hardly breathe.
Is that the man who killed Mommy? Naparye says.
Shh. You have to be quiet, no matter what. Don't make a sound. You promise me.
Yes.
The soldiers separate, 2 going to the left and 2 to the right. Ramses heads straight down the center, straight towards you.
I know you're here. Come on. Come out wherever you are.
You grab a good-sized rock and prepare to throw.
Come on, my little assassin. Come out. I'll make you a deal. You give yourself up,
and I promise you a quick death. Nothing like what Satya got. And I'll let the girl go. I've got nothing against the girl. She'll go back to the pyramids and have 3 meals a day. Now here's the other deal. If you don't give yourself up, if you choose to fight or hide, I'll kill you and the girl. Naparye looks at you, terrified. You put your finger in front of your lips and shake your head. Your camel sees Ramses and starts braying loudly. You curse the beast under your breath. Over here, Ramses calls out to the soldiers. Get your butts over here. Ramses peers around the corner and scans the clearing in front of the cave. Then Ramses' one good eye snaps into your direction. Oh, there you are. Come down from there. Remember our deal? There's no escape. Do you want the girl to live? You throw a stone. It bounces harmlessly off the walls. Big mistake, barbarian. Big mistake. To bring the point home, Ramses pulls out a hammer. The same hammer you killed his father with. I nailed Satya to her cross with this hammer. Takes a practice swing. This was Pop's hammer. We'll be happy to know it was put to good use. There's a shuffling behind you, the tumbling of loose stones. The officer's head appears over the ledge. He gives you an ugly, toothless grin. You hurl a stone at his face. It misses and glances off his helmet. That makes the officer mad. He pulls himself up so he stands on the ledge and hefts a battle axe from over his back. Naparye grabs your leg tight. You hurl another stone, but it just thuds against the armor and fur of the officer's burly chest. He doesn't even notice. He steps methodically forward. You quickly glance back and see Ramses is climbing the ledge behind you. The officer runs at you, axe raised. You hurl a stone, and this time it bounces off his forehead. The officer's eyes grow huge, and he slows down. His face is twisted in pain, and blood seeps from his lips. He raises his hands to the back of his neck and falls to his knees. Then, with a gurgle, he falls flat on his face. An arrow sticks out of the back of his neck. You don't have time to think. You pick up another stone and turn back to Ramses. He's just climbing up over the ledge and is kneeling, hammer in hand. He looks over at the officer, his face bent in surprise. From somewhere below, you hear the distinct twang of arrows, followed by the thud of bronze hitting flesh. What's going on down there? Ramses calls out. Then, people start to appear. There are dozens of them, lining the ledges and rocky bluffs. Each carries a bow. Bandits, Ramses says, his mouth agape. Bloody bandits. An arrow thuds into his thigh, then another one in his chest, another in his back. Then, all at once, Ramses' body is covered in arrows. His one good eye looks at you in disbelief before curling back into his head. Then, quietly, he falls over the ledge.
Who are you?
Says a man with a long beard. He leans on his bow.
We're fugitives.
Well, so are we. What did you do?
Killed a tax collector?
Everyone laughs. The man with the beard steps forward with a smile, his hand extended.
We were watching you last night. By the way you were acting, you looked like you were on the run. But it wasn't until the soldiers appeared that we knew for certain. You're welcome to join us. You and your daughter.
Oh, she's not my daughter.
You could have fooled me.
The girl is still holding onto your leg.
Well, you can stay with my family for now. Anyone who kills a tax collector is a welcome guest at my table.
The group laughs again, and soon you're shaking hands and being slapped on the back by everyone.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. I'd like to thank Cryochamber for the rich, dark ambient music you heard in this show. I'll post links in the show notes on the Twilight Histories website. If you enjoyed this show and you want to hear more, there is a store with tons of time travel adventure stories just waiting for you to download. When you purchase a story from the store, you help support this show. And I really appreciate it. Writing time travel adventure stories for you is something I'd like to do for a living, and building up the store, we can hope to get there one day. So please visit twilighthistories.com, click on the store, and browse all the titles. I'm sure you'll find something you'll like. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.
You've been listening to The Twilight Histories with Jordan Harbour.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.